I'm going to be reading from Colossians 1, 11 through 23. Being strengthened with all power, according to his glorious might, for all endurance and patience with joy, giving thanks to the Father, who has qualified you to share in the inheritance of the saints in light. He has delivered us from the domain of darkness and transferred us to the kingdom of his beloved Son, in whom we have redemption, the forgiveness of sins. He is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation. For by him all things were created, in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or rulers or authorities, all things were created through him and for him. And he is before all things, and in him all things hold together. And he is the head of the body, the church. He is the beginning, the firstborn from the dead, that in everything he might be preeminent. For in him all the fullness of God was pleased to dwell, and through him to reconcile to himself all things, whether in earth or in heaven, making peace by the blood of his cross. And you, who once were alienated and hostile in mind, doing evil deeds, he is now reconciled in his body of flesh by his death, in order to present you holy and blameless and above reproach before him, if indeed you continue in the faith, stable and steadfast, not shifting from the hope of the gospel that you heard, which has been proclaimed in all creation under heaven, and of which I, Paul, became a minister.
We've been doing a series of messages on the attributes of God during these summer months, each week taking one character trait, one aspect of God's being, one attribute, and trying to explore a little bit of that. Of course, no message could even come close to being able to grasp the fullness of God's character in each of these areas, but hopefully, little by little, we can make our way through and think on these areas. Someone has said that worship is pure or base as the worshiper entertains high or low thoughts of God. Worship is pure or base as the worshiper entertains high or low thoughts of God. During the course of this week, what were your thoughts about God? Were they there? High or low? And so in this study, we want to try to do our very best as we explore these attributes to understand the grandeur of what God has revealed himself to be, to grasp their truths. Given that we are often at odds with God, we are forever trying to cut God down to size, to make him less than he is. So is the sinfulness and sickness of the human heart. And so, God help us, Lord help us this morning to wrestle with the fullness of the revelation that you have given about yourself. Over and over again in the pages of the scriptures, God is revealing himself as he is. He says, I am this way and not that way. I do these things and not those things. And so we have to take the revelation of God, the self-revelation of him, and wrestle with what does it mean? And today we want to think about this one, the solitariness and supremacy of God. I suspect that solitariness is not an attribute that most of us think about very often. In fact, it's possible that some in this room have never even heard of that as applied to God. What does it mean to say that God is the solitary God? What is the solitariness of God? If you look up solitary in the dictionary, the definition for that as an adjective is it means alone. It refers to the idea of the uniqueness of God, that among all of the beings that exist in the universe, there is one being, God, who is in a class all by himself, utterly unique, none like him that exists in all of existent matter. In the study of biology, we have a particular discipline called taxonomy. And taxonomy is the discipline, many of you serve in a variety of work that may deal with this in one way or another, but taxonomy is the discipline, the scientific study of naming and defining and classifying organisms. Well, when it comes to God, what class do you put him in? You see, God is utterly unique. There is none like him. And that's why on many, many pages of the Bible, here's one from Isaiah 40, where God says, "To whom will you compare me that I should be like him?" says the Holy One. To whom shall you compare me that I should be like him? So this morning, as we try to meditate on this particular text, it's not the only one, but it's a very important one that talks about this idea of the solitariness of God and the supremacy of God. And here in chapter 1, we see Paul writing to the Colossian church and giving them a very dense paragraph about the solitariness of God. And let's just pick for a moment, let's just look at some of the description that Paul gives to us in regards of this. First of all, and we recognize that he says that he's the invisible God. That is, God in his essence is a spirit without a body. That he is the creator of all things. And that his purpose of creation was such that it would be created through and for him. And that he is before all things, meaning he is the most significant, the most important, the most weighty being in all the universe. And then lastly, we are told that he holds all things together. One writer, A.W. Pink, puts it this way: God in his solitary excellency, God is solitary in his excellency. There was a time when God as a tri-unity dwelt all alone. In the beginning, God. There was no heavens or heaven, no earth to engage his attention, no angels to hymn his praises, no universe to be upheld by the word of his power. There was nothing, no one but God. And that not for a day, a year, or an age, but from everlasting. During a past eternity, God was alone, self-existing, self-sufficient, self-satisfied, in need of nothing. Have you ever taken a moment just to contemplate that truth? That there was a time, if you could call it that, in which God existed and there was nothing else. And he existed for eternity after eternity after eternity. When you stop and take a moment to allow that thought just to begin to absorb the immensity of it, the enormity of it, it does boggle the mind, does it not? It is the kind of thought, the kind of reality that when you bump up against it, you realize that you have just bumped up against the godness of God. And it ought for us to lead us to enormous, humble worship. Such is the being of God, the solitary being. None like him. He is in a class by himself. A.W. Tozer, in thinking about this, said this: "It is not a cheerful thought that millions of us who live in a land of Bibles, who belong to churches and who labor to promote the Christian religion, may not yet pass our whole life in this earth without having once thought or tried to think seriously about the being of God. Few of us have let our hearts gaze in wonder at the I Am, the self-existent self, back of which no creature can think. Such thoughts are too painful for us. We prefer to think where it will do more good, about how to build a better mousetrap, for instance, or how to make two blades of grass grow where one grew before. And for this, we are now paying a heavy price in the secularization of our religion and the decay of our inner lives. Perhaps some sincere but puzzled Christian may, at this juncture, wish to inquire about the practicality of such concepts as I am trying to set forth here. What bearing does this have on my life, he may ask? What possible meaning can the self-existence of God have for me and others like me in a world such as this and in times such as these? To this I reply, because we are the handiwork of God, it follows that all our problems and their solutions are theological ones. And I think that Tozer is right. God is a solitary being. There is none like him, in a class by himself. And the Bible, of course, urges us to think about such grand things, to have high thoughts of God. The greatness of his character, the solitariness of his excellency. But quite honestly, there is a bit of a flaw in it. And that is, of course, not with God himself, but it is rather abstract. These aspects or attributes of God can be rather abstract, rather out there. It may be amaze your mind, but never really change the heart. And of course, God is not interested in only your heart, your mind being amazed. He wants to get at your heart. And so, of course, all over in the pages of the Bible, he does not allow his character or his attributes to remain impersonal to you. And if you take a careful look at this passage in Colossians chapter 1, verses 15 through 23, what we begin to realize is that God is pleased to make himself, to reveal himself as knowable. Not just an abstract idea or an amazing attribute, but God wants you to know him. And so in Colossians chapter 1, what we see Paul giving to us is that God has made himself knowable by revealing himself in the person of Jesus Christ. Colossians 1, at the heart of it is a reality to help us realize the revelation of God in the person of Christ. Notice with me again, let's go back and look again at these verses in which what Paul says to us. Notice that in verses 13 and 14, he 12 and 13, he says, Paul is giving thanks. He says, I give thanks to the Father who has qualified you to share in the inheritance of the saints. He has delivered us from the dominion of darkness and brought us into the kingdom of the Son he loves, in whom we have redemption, the forgiveness of sins. And then the very next words and the very next line is, he is. And when he says he is, he uses the personal pronoun he is. What Paul is telling us is that he is knowable. He is not some idea or some abstract attribute or character, rather, a person. And of course, we know that to be him referring to the person of Christ, because in that verse he says to us that he transferred us out of the kingdom of darkness into the kingdom of his beloved Son. And then Paul begins to talk to us about who the Son is. And let's notice again, Jesus, he is the image of the invisible God. Jesus himself, as in one other place in Hebrews, is the exact representation of the invisible God. You cannot see an invisible God. How are you going to get to know that God? And so Jesus comes as the image of the invisible God. Not only that, but he is the firstborn of all creation. When we hear the word firstborn, we tend to think of birth, some kind of, that there was a time when he wasn't, then there were a time that he was the one who was born first. That's not how the word is used or the phrase is meant in the Bible. Firstborn has to do with the idea of the heir. The firstborn was the one who received everything. When Paul says that Jesus is the firstborn of all creation, he's saying that he is the heir of creation. It all is going to come to him. He is the creator of all things. All things were created through him and for him. He is the purpose of creation, and everything will be his own. He is before all things. He is the most significant and important of all things and all that exists. And he is the one, if you can stand it, who holds the whole thing together. Now, why? Why does Jesus do all those things? Notice in verse 18 that in everything he might be preeminent. That is to say that he might be seen as the supreme Lord. Not only is God this solitary being who is in a class by himself, but also he is the supreme Lord over all things. This past week was Angela and my 30th anniversary, and we took a few days away. And while we were away, we found a little bed and breakfast a couple hours a drive away, and I took this picture looking over the New River Valley. And as we were sitting there and I was looking at that picture, the thought occurred to me that here is a picture just in one frame of acre after acre after acre of land. And within this one frame, in those thousands of acres, which only I could, just the amount that I could see, are literally maybe 100 million types of various life forms. Insects, bugs, birds, animals, all doing their little thing that no one ever sees or observes. They're just out there doing what they were made to do. And that is just one frame, one picture of thousands of acres, and within those thousands of acres, just life after life after life. And one of those little things out there in the evening that I noticed was this little guy, the firefly, the lightning bug. I was about to say ladybug, and you'd have a lot of questions about my taxonomy. Did you know that the firefly, which we pass by just at hardly even think about it, that there are 2,000 species of fireflies? And did you know that firefly lights are the most efficient light in all of the world, that 100% of the energy in that little abdomen is converted into light, compared to an incandescent bulb, which is 10% light and 90% heat? Did you know that in a firefly's tail, there are two chemicals? One is luciferase and the other luciferin. Luciferin is a heat-resistant kind of chemical, and it glows under just the right conditions. And luciferase is an enzyme that triggers that light emission. And there is, within the firefly's body, another chemical called ATP that converts the energy and initiates the glow. And did you know that in a firefly's life, that it will fly over in these thousands of species, as it flies, it will flash its light every 6 seconds, the males will, low to the ground, and the female will be able to detect by the flashing of that particular kind of light in that kind of sequence whether or not he is of the same species as her. And in order to be able to, for the two of those to come together, that little firefly will flash its light. And as it passes over, when that female detects that it's the right kind, she will flash her light and they will be able to come together. Jesus did all that. And he upholds the firefly. Why? To show that not only is he the solitary God, but the supreme Lord. And that in everything he might be preeminent. Now, why is Paul pointing out the supremacy of Jesus? Why does Paul say that in everything that he does, he might be preeminent, the supreme Lord? Why does Paul want these believers in Colossae to know about the absolute lordship, the unrivaled preeminence, the majesty of this glorious Lord? And the answer to that question is to show them and to show you and I that not only is he the supreme Lord, but he is the sufficient Savior. Notice again, let's go back and look at these verses. Notice again how many times Paul uses the word all or all things. Verse 15, he is the firstborn of all creation. Verse 16, by him all things were created. All things were created through him and for him. Verse 17, he is before all things, and in him all things hold together. And then again in verse 19, in him all the fullness of God was pleased to dwell. Don't you think Paul has a point to be made when he captures that in everything, in all things, Jesus is the one who has done it all, who holds it all together, who brings it into its order? And there are two questions worth asking at this point. First, what does the Supreme Lord, who does all these things with creation, what does this Supreme Lord do with his majestic position and place and power? What does this Supreme Lord who owns it all, the Supreme Lord who holds it all together, the Supreme Lord who created it all and made it for his own purpose and glory, what does that Supreme Lord who holds this position of exalted authority, what does he do with all of that? Notice in verse 20, and through him to reconcile to himself all things, whether on earth or in heaven, by making peace by the blood of his cross. What was his greatest act, this supreme, majestic Lord? What was his greatest act? I can tell you what it's not. It's not sustaining fireflies. The greatest act of this majestic, solitary God is to reconcile with rebellious, lost sinners, with people who want nothing to do with him, with people who blame him, with people who ignore him, with people who resist him, with people who go through life thinking that they are owed everything, with people who sinfully serve their own purposes. You see, in all of his majestic glory, God marshaled the powers of heaven to come after you. And you might ask, well, was it really that bad? Notice verse 21. And you who were once alienated and hostile in mind, doing evil deeds. This glorious, solitary, majestic, supreme Lord did not write you off. Did not say, fine, if that's the way you want it, you can have it. But rather, he came after you. And A.B.W. Tozer, again so wisely put it, sin has many manifestations, but its essence is one. A moral being created to worship before the throne of God sits on the throne of his own selfhood, and from that elevated position declares, I am. This is sin in its concentrated essence. Yet it is because it is natural and appears to be good. It is only when in the gospel the soul is brought before the face of the Most Holy One without the protective shield of ignorance that the frightful moral incongruity is brought home to the conscience. And so the question is for us this morning then, how does he go about reconciling us? Is it simply by the click of his fingers? Is it simply because he plopped down into your life and demanded you to give up your foolish ways? Is it because somehow that he just forced it to happen upon you? No. Look again there at verse 21. He did it by making peace by the blood of the cross. He did it by shedding his own blood. And that leads us to this final question. If Christ is the supreme Lord who sustains fireflies and the whole universe, who sustains you, is it reasonable for you and for me to go through life doubting his power to sustain us? Is it reasonable for this majestic, glorious, supreme Lord who marshaled the powers of heaven to come running after you, is it reasonable for you and I to question his capacity or his intentions or his ability to sustain you from your conversion to glory? Notice as we look here in verse 22, he has now reconciled us in the body of his flesh by his death, in order to present you holy and blameless and above reproach before him. Don't you see God's intentions? Don't you see God's commitments? Don't you see what God is after for you? And is it reasonable for us to fear and to worry that somehow the Lord is going to get it wrong in your life. One little story as we close. I've told this before. Some of you have heard this before. If so, just bear with me. Others of you have not. Years ago, when I was a little boy, my parents were missionaries in Indonesia. We lived in a very remote area. They were working with a tribal people called the Danis. There weren't any roads where we lived. You either walked or you flew by small airplane. And we lived in one particular valley, and on the way that food was brought in was you made an order and a plane would arrive after some time had gone by, and all your food would come, and then you would make life go as long as that food supply had been given. And as long as that food, that supply chain wasn't disrupted, life was pretty good. But occasionally there would be times when there were no shipments that were coming typically out of Australia and brought into the port, and then from the port they would be disseminated and so forth. And on one particular occasion, there had been no ability to be able to put in an order, and so there's no planes coming. And we were down to eating oatmeal every day. And after a while, I was 3 or 4 years old, after a while I'd gotten tired of that oatmeal. And just as a little child, I said to my mom and dad, I'd like an egg. And my dad, being a good dad, thought, well, tomorrow morning I'll get up real early while it's still dark, and I'll try to make the journey across the mountain range, over the village, over the river, and to the next closest little market. Maybe there'll be somebody there who's happened to be selling eggs. He gets up early in the morning, it's still dark, tried to make the hour plus walk to get over there and then to get back before a 3-year-old boy gets up and walks out the door, and there's a Donny woman standing there in the dark. And they didn't usually come that early, they usually waited until it got light. And so, you know, as a typical father, oh brother, what's this about, what's the delay? And there she held 3 little eggs that she wanted to sell. May I ask you something? If there is a solitary God, who is the supreme Lord, who is the sufficient Savior, who listens to little boys' requests? Just for an egg. Do you think that somehow he's going to get it wrong in your life? Do you think that he who gave his body of flesh to reconcile you to God by making peace through his blood is going to let you slip through his fingers? I don't know how the Lord will work in your particular circumstance. I don't know all that will happen between your conversion and glory. But I do know this, that Paul says to us in Colossians chapter 1 that he is working to present you holy and blameless and above reproach before his glorious throne. And he has marshaled the powers of heaven to come after you. The God who sustains fireflies knows how to sustain your life. And so, as we close this morning, may I only encourage you as Paul completes his thought there in Colossians chapter 1 with these words. In order to present you holy and blameless and above reproach before him, if indeed you continue in the faith, stable and steadfast, not shifting from the hope of the gospel that you heard. Stay put. You're walking through deep waters. You're going through things you don't understand. You're going through things that you didn't ask for and don't like. Stay put. He will sustain you and hold you. He is the solitary, supreme God who is also your sufficient Savior. And so we close with these words. Fountain of good, all blessing flows. From there no want thy fullness knows. Yet self-sufficient as thou art, thou dost desire my worthless heart. This, only this, dost thou require.